We do continue in our creation story today. We are on day five already, or maybe some of you are thinking, only day five? To me, it's already. Feels like we just started. But so before we get into day five, though, before we get into our Genesis passage, I really wanted to share this last week because it relates really well to last week's. But you only need one sermon a day, or a Sunday, so. I wanted to tell you about the creation story as underneath it all, okay? There's some fun facts about the creation story that you may not know. Because it was written with an incredible amount of intention and attention. It was crafted very carefully with, like, a purpose and a structure. And you might say, well, yes, of course, it's in the Bible. Of course it was crafted on purpose and with intention. But there's a level of like technicality here, a level of poetry here that isn't immediately obvious to the naked eye. There's this level of careful construction that might surprise us if we dig underneath it a little bit. And it's important that we connect to that fact. It's also really fun for me. So just, you know, humor me. For example, there are 7 days of creation. Okay, we know this. But the number seven is not random. In this story, God saw creation and called it good 7 times. And the word for earth or land in Hebrew, eretz, is in this story 21 times, which is a multiple of 7. And in Hebrew, Genesis 1:1 consists of 7 words. Genesis 1:2 has 14 words, also a multiple of 7. Genesis 1:3 has 35 words, also a multiple of 7. The number 7 is a unique number mathematically. Dave, I should have asked you to just, because I don't know how to explain it, but I was reading all about it. You just love the number 7. It's a special number. I did read about it, but I can't tell you about it. You'll have to trust me that 7 is absolutely fascinating. I'm sure Dave would love to tell you about it after the service. But one commentator said that the mathematical order of this story, quote, imparts a remarkable mathematical aesthetic, the quantifiable order of a fully stable, life-sustaining, differentiated world, end quote. I don't really know what that means, but I knew Dave would appreciate it. But I also agree somehow. So the number 7 is really special, and the people who constructed this story knew that. But 7 also may have been important to these ancient brothers and sisters of ours because there were, at that time and still now, but there were 7 celestial bodies visible to the naked eye. So they did not have telescopes, but they could see what they could see. So from Earth, they could see the sun and the moon, obviously, but they could also see Venus, Mercury, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn from where they stood on Earth. So there were 7 celestial bodies. And the story of creation is really uniquely cosmically oriented. It would not surprise me that they drew inspiration from what they were seeing. When you see these 7 bright lights all the time, you have to start wondering, what does this mean? How important is this? And finally, it's helpful to know that the number 7 in the culture of the ancient Hebrews carried with it a sense of completion or perfection or holiness. Creation is understood and experienced as complete on that 7th day, right? We know that, but it's no accident. And so all the math aside, the careful construction of this story is also apparent in a way that is maybe a bit more obvious to us. Do we have, yeah. Is it on there? Just gotta click past this. Okay, can we just go to the next slide? Nope, sorry. Thank you. Okay. So we can see this a little bit more in English than all those other things that we see more in Hebrew. But the days of creation actually create these 2 symmetrical pillars, right? Days 1, 2, and 3 over here on your left are the domains that God created and differentiated, separated out, right? He created The light and the night separated them out. The firmament and waters below, they're separated. Land is pulled back from the waters. And then days 4, 5, and 6 on the other side are what fill those domains. And you see the way that they're coordinated. So we're done with day 3 here. 4, the lights fill the light, the night and the light. Aviary life, so birds fill the firmament. Marine life fills the water below. Land animals fill the land, humans eventually too. And food is transformed. Or vegetation is transformed into food. So there's this coordination, this mirror, this symmetry that I never realized was there before. And on top of that, we have what was before all of that, the tohu vavohu, the void, the vacuum, the meaninglessness at the top, right? Paralleled with day 7. Day 7 is this creation completed, holy. You see how those mirror each other? The chaos, the void, is now full and meaningful and ordered. And this is important. There's a reason I'm telling you all this. Is if you remember way back in day 2, when God separated the waters below from the waters above, we had a moment to acknowledge that that was maybe a bit embarrassing, because we know now that there are no waters up there. There's no water up there. We know there isn't water, so makes us a little uncomfortable sometimes. Like, come on, Bible, that's score 1 for science, right? Take one from the Bible. And as we've gotten deeper into the story, there's more of those moments. Last week, we talked about day 3 and 4, okay? So maybe we missed it because we kind of smushed them together. But in that sequence of those days, vegetation is created before the sun. Vegetation is created before the sun. And I am not a scientist by trade, mathematician or scientist. But I do know that plants need light to live. So there's like kind of this nonsensical order, right? Like, well, why would that happen? If we know plants need sun to live, how could that possibly be? Come on, Bible. But the truth of the matter is this. The Bible only loses points if we try to get it to play a game that it has no interest in playing. Okay, the Bible and science have some beautiful conversations together, but it is not a biology textbook. It's not a physics textbook. It's not written to teach us how plants live, right? If we keep expecting the Bible to explain things it wasn't trying to explain in the first place, we're going to keep getting kind of embarrassed by it. Or maybe even worse is what we do. We're going to keep trying to twist it and force it into what we need it to be in order to explain away what we might see as mistakes. Okay, so neither of those options are what God intends when we open our Bibles. If we need this to be a science book, we miss the artistry of a story like the creation story, the poetry of that. We miss that it's trying to show us something, that it's trying to teach us something, that it's trying to shape us, trying to help us gain wisdom. We can try to explain away these scientific inaccuracies in the Bible, or we can ask why something is told the way that it's told and listen for what it's trying to teach. So when we stop needing the Bible to like explain things it's not trying to explain, science and religion are no longer enemies, or science and the Bible, however you want to put it. They're no longer enemies, just different modes of God's revelation. They're partners, they're friends, they're not enemies. There's a lot more we could say about the construction of this particular story, but I think that's probably enough fun facts for the day. We'll talk more about the significance of the story's construction when we get to the seventh day specifically. But the point is, the way this story is constructed and told is no accident. And it's not a mistake that, you know, that the vegetation was created before the lights. It's not a mistake that it's telling us that there's water above, and we now know there is no water above. because it's not trying to explain that. We have to look underneath it and look for what it's trying to teach us and tell us. And it's also coming from a particular time and place with limited availability of telescopes, for example, and scientific inquiry. So as we head into day five, we now know what's happening in day five is because of what happened in day two. We're talking about birds and fish today because on day two, we talked about the sky and the waters below. Isn't that interesting? So, Genesis 1, 20 through 23 is where we are today. And God said, "Let the waters bring forth swarms of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the dome of the sky." So God created the great sea monsters and every living creature that moves of every kind, with which the waters swarm, and every winged bird of every kind. And God saw that it was good. God blessed them, saying, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters and the seas, and let birds multiply on the earth." And there was evening and there was morning, the fifth day. The skies and the seas are filling with life here. And this is, you know, you saw, I kind of did that. In Hebrew, when we learned the word, what the word blessed means, that was our hand motion for it, blessed. Last week, we talked about how God shares power. That word blessed, that's what that means. So God is blessing them, sharing his power, giving them power to be fruitful and multiply. So imagine a God who meticulously shapes and organizes the stuff of creation, which we saw in those first 3 days, and then meticulously and with love begins filling those spaces with nothing that's ever been imagined before. What science has slowly revealed over time is how these creatures that fill the seas and the skies are vital for life as we know it on this earth. There's a headline from National Geographic that reads, "Source of half Earth's oxygen gets little credit." And it explains that plant respiration is only responsible for half of the oxygen that we breathe. Only half. The other half comes from these tiny little ocean dwellers called phytoplankton that also metabolize carbon dioxide. I never learned that. The ocean is teeming with swarms of things that literally give us oxygen to breathe. We need them. Listen to the opening verses of Psalm 24. "The earth is the Lord's and all that is in it, the world and those who live in it. For he has founded it on the seas and established it on the rivers." Audubon magazine asked its readers, "Why do birds matter?" Melanie Driscoll, a director of bird conservation, she answered it this way in that article. She said, "Birds are important because they keep systems in balance. They pollinate plants, disperse seeds, scavenge carcasses, and recycle nutrients back into the earth." So just like the ocean contains these tiny little creatures that give us oxygen to breathe, the birds of the air are responsible for other processes that we completely depend on and need. It's easy for us to live like we can create everything we need, isn't it? I remember listening to someone talk about how they hoped that someday there would just be a pill you could take that would give you all the nutrients you would need instead of having to find food and make it. And I thought, man, that sounds sad. That sounds really sad, but it's easy for us to believe we can do those things. It's easy for us to believe or to live like we have some kind of control over this earth. It's good for us to remember that our lives are completely dependent on God and what God has created to sustain us. Amen. And God called this good. God called this good, but God called this good before there was a reason to see the birds and the fish as practical or useful. before they became the source of our oxygen, before we knew or could experience them as important pollinators. God called them good before they were useful to us. That's another humbling thing to hold on to. God called these creatures good because it made him happy. It brought him joy. If you've ever created anything and sat back with a smile on your face and a warm feeling of joy in your chest, then you know exactly what I'm talking about. God sat back and thought, wow, this is good. This is good. That satisfaction, the joy. And even if what has been made is just to look at, like a painting, it's not useful, right? Practical, but it brings beauty and joy into this world. And some things are useful, some things are just beautiful, and some things are both. Melanie Driscoll, that bird conservationist who just reminded us a moment ago of how useful birds are and needed to sustain life, she went on to say this. She said, but they also feed our spirits, marking for us the passage of seasons, moving us to create art and poetry, inspiring us to flight, and reminding us that we are not only on, but of this earth. Ooh. We birdwatch, don't we? It brings a lot of people joy. We birdwatch, we eagerly await the orioles passing through in the spring. We build airplanes because they inspired us to. We look for their color in the dead of winter. I am so grateful to see a cardinal. We watch for them as reminders of loved ones who have passed. God found joy and satisfaction in what he created before it became useful to us. And sometimes when we slow down enough, we can do the same. So thank God for blessing the world with the building blocks of life as we know it. Thank you. For the oxygen and the mysteries of the ocean and the pollinators and the carcass scavengers of the sky. And thank God for blessing us with the beauty of it all. Guys, isn't it just cool? Isn't it amazing? Sometimes that's all, like, that's honestly the point of this sermon. Sometimes I just need to point to things and say, isn't this so cool? Isn't that neat? I think it's so neat. But there's something that draws us deeper, and sometimes I'm not meant to name that for you. I hope that all of these maybe boring or interesting or however you want to interpret them, fun facts and thoughts are drawing you deeper into some sort of devotional moment. The construction of the story of creation in Genesis is so interesting and cool and beautiful. Symmetry and intention and purpose. And this creator God who keeps sitting back to look at the work of his hands and praising it, naming it, and calling it good. That's beautiful. The way that science helps us discover the wisdom and brilliance of God's creation. The symmetry and the intention of all of it. The way that even if we knew nothing about the creatures of the sky and the creatures of the water and how useful they were, they would still be good and beautiful to us. Isn't that just so cool? Jesus preached about birds a lot. Jesus frequently used fish as a teaching tool to teach people about God and who God is. And in some ways, Jesus was just like us, observing God's good creation and seeing the way that it teaches us about who God is and how beautiful it is. But in other ways, Jesus was very different. Jesus has an experience with creation that we can never, ever have, because Jesus the man is also Jesus the Christ. And Christ has been communing with creation since the beginning of time, since the beginning of creation. John 1, verses 1 through 5 say this. In the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God, and the Word was God, and he was in the beginning with God. All things came into being through him, and without him, no one thing came into being. What has come into being in him was life, and the life was the light of all people. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not overtake it. Christ was there and has been there. Today is Communion Sunday, and we come to this table as a sign and symbol of God's choice to commune with us, his beloved creation, even though he knew what it cost. He knew the cost from the beginning, beginning. God knows the cost now. God knew the beauty of it then, and God knows the beauty of it now. That story from the beginning that was so carefully and intentionally and carefully crafted, the story from the very beginning that was written to teach us about who God is the same story that Jesus was still telling through his life and ministry and death. And it's the same story that is still unfolding every day now. That story at the beginning has never ended. We just get to join it. We read this verse from Colossians when we learned about the firmament back in day two, and it bears repeating now. This is Colossians chapter 1, verses 15 through 17. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For in him all things in heaven and on earth were created, things visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or powers. All things have been created through him and for him. He himself is before all things, and in him all things hold together.